You've got to kill that thing inside you that goes, this is just the way it is.
Right.
You've got to be willing to sort of kill that demon and question all those things. And then you've got to get comfortable with the fact that, like, good questions, they lead to answers, but those answers lead to better questions.
Welcome back to the Moonshots episode of Future Proof. As always, I am your host, Bill Sheridan. And why moonshots? Well, a couple of reasons. First, I'm a full-blown space nerd, and with the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing coming up, I'm geeking out pretty hard about anything space-related these days. And second, our guests this week are going to challenge us to start thinking in terms of moonshots. In other words, huge, seemingly insurmountable quests, but ultimately inspirational and game-changing in nature. My guests are Sharif Halaba and Travis Dirks. They are the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Technology Officer, respectively, for an organization named X Labs. They describe themselves as a company that builds moonshot companies for the future, powered by artificial intelligence, unconventional computing, and neurotechnology. And if that sounds a little out there for our little podcast, well, it is, but they make a pretty strong argument that adopting a moonshot mindset has some very tangible benefits for accounting and finance pros. So keep listening. There's some good stuff here. A couple of housekeeping items before we get rolling. First, now is a good time to tell you that this week's podcast is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. Now, next is what caught my eye this week. Fast Company is running a series of 50 articles in the 50 days leading up to the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing, which is coming up on July 20th. The seeds for Apollo 11, of course, were planted 8 years earlier in that famous speech by President John F. Kennedy, which included the call to action from which the term moonshot originated.
I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
That speech was an address on May 25th, 1961, to a joint session of Congress. And according to Fast Company's Charles Fishman, it almost didn't happen. Here's an excerpt from Fishman's article. He writes, quote, "The fact that Congress and the American people heard Kennedy rally them to race for the moon was the result of a last-minute change of heart. Until less than a day before he gave that speech, Kennedy had no intention of actually delivering it. He was just going to send it to Congress as a printed text, a message to Congress to be read aloud by clerks to any members who wanted to sit and listen. The day before the speech, Wednesday, that morning's New York Times reported, quote, the president considered, then decided against delivering the message in person to a joint session of Congress. But Wednesday afternoon, just 21 hours before he would deliver the speech, Kennedy changed his mind, in part at the urging of Vice President Lyndon Johnson, who thought the message would have much more power if delivered by Kennedy in person. Thursday morning's Washington Post, in its front page news story, said Kennedy hoped delivering the speech personally would spark a revival of spirit in Washington. Ever since the Cuban invasion fiasco, the bloom has been off the bright rose of the early days of the new administration, the Post reported, adding that Some said, in fact, that the president's purpose is to recreate some of the spirit of his January 30th State of the Union speech, one of the most widely praised of such addresses in many a year. And it worked, Fishman writes. The next day's newspapers blazoned Kennedy's call to go to the moon across their front pages as if that was all the speech had been about. Congress immediately lined up to provide billions in funding that Kennedy had requested. NASA's staff and contractors would double within a year. And 4 years later, NASA and its contractors would be nine times the size they had been when Kennedy took office. It's hard to imagine, in fact, that the race to the moon would have been undertaken with anything like that urgency and political support if Kennedy hadn't made the speech in person. End quote. That's what a moonshot is all about. Imagining something groundbreaking and convincing those around you that it's important and possible. Now, you know, I get it. We all can't and won't begin to start creating these groundbreaking moments. That's more than a little unrealistic. But what we can do is start thinking in terms of moonshots, adopting kind of a moonshot mindset that embraces the reality of exponential change and imagine what might be possible. And that's the message that Sharif Halaba and Travis Dirks deliver on this week's show. The genesis for this conversation was a keynote address at the 2019 Digital Now Conference by Dr. Radhika Dirks, the CEO of X Labs, in which she said that moonshots are about embracing novelty and that a key mindset of building moonshots is to embrace the non-linear, to think exponentially. When innovating, Dr. Dirk said, it's important to diverge before you converge. Start with no constraints on thinking. And that, I think, is the message of this week's show. In a world of exponential change, our thinking has to start with the idea that almost anything is going to be possible going forward. And the more we get comfortable with that mindset, the more future ready we'll become. So a thought-provoking conversation here. Here are Sharif Halaba and Travis Dirks. So Sharif, Travis, thanks for joining me today. I saw a talk online that Dr. Dirks gave recently, Radhika Dirks, in which she said that the future in her mind is, quote, man superpowered by machines, which I've kind of thought was pretty interesting. What does she mean by that? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, well, our kind of vision for the distant future and where we're trying to head to sort of as a human race is how can we sort of superpower ourselves with technology in ways that lets it fade into the background and just gives us the ability to do the things we need to do without it being the focus of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the heart of what she was speaking towards there is the future looks less like kind of Blade Runner and more like a natural setting in which we just happen to have a lot more abilities than a sort of a spec human off the shelf has.
Yeah. So in other words, we're not necessarily competing with machines for our jobs. We're looking for ways that machines and humans can kind of augment what each other does in order to provide greater value.
Absolutely, yeah. We've got very different abilities than sort of computers and algorithms. And so when you put those abilities in combination, you can do a lot more. You can do things that neither can do on their own.
Yeah.
So we call this type of intelligence amplified intelligence to distinguish it from artificial intelligence. And it's really the focus of what we're working on is how can we build things that we can't do now instead of focusing on just sort of simply replacing human beings.
Yeah, that's cool. Kind of expand on that for a little bit, that idea of amplified intelligence versus artificial intelligence. How do you distinguish between the two?
Sure. So there's lots of, if you ask 20 different people, what is AI? You'll get 20 different answers. But kind of the heart of it is AI historically is about teaching machines to mimic the things that come naturally to us. Mm-hmm. So can a robot walk? Can it speak? Can it respond to what I say? Can it drive a car, et cetera? These are sort of really simple things for human beings to do, and it turns out to be quite difficult to get machines to do them. And that's sort of the field of AI. Mm-hmm. And amplified intelligence is sort of moving away from what's easy for us and asking, what are things we can't do? And what are things that are also historically hard for computers to do? And how do we get computers to actually do those things? And that usually involves finding new ways to insert some of the human, whether that is through direct interaction with humans or whether that's through pulling knowledge out of the sciences so that AI has access to things that we as humanity have discovered over our existence. Yeah.
You know, Travis, Joko Wilkins has recently I heard him talking about the importance of morale in battle. Joko Wilkins is a former Navy SEAL, a student of warfare and history. And I thought actually a really interesting analog example of amplified intelligence or amplified capabilities is this concept of wartime morale. Because typically human beings are optimized for survival. And so he talks about the importance for people leading troops into battle to maintain a high level of morale, because morale is the thing that will let you surpass your human boundary of only focusing on survival and go face first into an onslaught of oncoming bullets, for example, or do the mission that no one else will do. And so I think there are a lot of analog examples of how we sort of hacked the human brain in the past to do things beyond natural human capability. And technology today stands in a place where there are a lot of things like that that we could be exploring as well with tech.
Yeah, I think things like that are still actually highly relevant on the analog side as well, because a lot of the reason that you don't see people being future-proofed is that there is this negativity bias. There is this sort of, in our evolutionary history, we tended to live near the survival line. And so we tend to react much more strongly to negative things than we do positively towards positive things.
Right.
Which makes sense evolutionarily, but it doesn't make sense in a world where if you mess up, you're still going to be able to eat tomorrow.
Well, that's, you know, and that might tie into my next question. So, because during her session at Digital Now, Dr. Dirks, she also made the point, which I thought was kind of interesting, that we've come to a point where technology's goal is in a lot of ways to mimic nature. So she gave the examples of AI mimics the brain, right? Quantum computing kind of mimics the atom. DNA computing mimics the gene. And you know, to those of us who are just kind of trying to make it through our day alive, I think that stuff can sound, I don't know, intimidating at best and maybe a little terrifying at worst. So I'm wondering if you can kind of bring that down to our level. What does something like that mean for, say, you know, someone who works in accounting and finance? Why is that an important concept to embrace in this day and age?
Yeah, I think ultimately why it's important is that, okay, so why is that the case? Why is it that the sort of three most powerful types of computing that are the bleeding edge of technology now are mimicking things in nature? The reason is that nature has existed for a really long time and has been doing its thing for a really long time, and it turns out to be powerful to kind of learn from it. So I think at the kind of base level, if I'm just sort of picking this up in my life, very far from computing, the thing to notice is that nature is really, really efficient at a lot of things. So it tends to be useful to look for inspiration in how nature works. So just as an example, you know, in a parallel universe where people who study ants were also interested in internet search, people who studied ants could have invented PageRank, which was one of the things that led to Google. Because that algorithm looks very similar to the way ants wander around and lay down chemical trails. And the more chemical there is on the trail, the more ants follow it, et cetera.
Wow.
So I would be thinking about, I don't want to focus on problems because a lot of times it's more powerful to focus on opportunities. But in the work that you're doing, can you find analogs in nature, and how does nature solve problems like that?
I think the Japanese bullet trains come from, I think that book Biomimicry talks a lot about how scientists have pulled on nature for design principles.
Absolutely.
So we've already seen that in action. Dr. Dirk's focused on the compute, on tying compute to nature, which I think is the first time I've heard someone do that. But we've definitely seen technology come from nature in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, one thing, Bill, for I think more of like a finance-oriented perspective to technology, I think... Listen, when you look back at the last few decades of technology development, you know, the only reason we can keep up with it as things progress is because, you know, the finance folks are getting closer to the builders over time, you know, and, you know,
say that again, closer to what?
To the builders, to the people who are actually implementing.
Okay.
You know, if you go way back in the day, you had, you know, guys like Nikola Tesla pitching folks like JP Morgan, and those two were on completely different wavelengths. I mean, on certain days, they were both excited about building tech. One wanted to fund the other needed, you know, money for survival. And so, you know, let's say JP Morgan wanted one thing out of Tesla, let's say a wireless communication device, and Tesla wanted to build, you know, free power and teleportation. You know, that's the basic principle of a very failed partnership, because one wanted to build one thing and the other person wanted to fund something completely different. They didn't have a common ground for discussion. And as we've evolved from there, Silicon Valley has gotten better at understanding how to build products, how to ship SaaS tools. You know, a lot of product folks have made it onto the venture capital community to be able to de-risk those projects and kind of close that market fit gap. And so when we look at like the next phase of technology, I think it's really important to realize that being able to solve all the problems in the room with the people that existed 10 years ago or even 5 years ago is probably not the most efficient way of doing it. I think you need to introduce new players into that room when you're trying to solve problems that are exponentially more complex. And that's sort of, I think, fundamentally a background of, you know, why we're building XLabs the way we've built it, with a slew of technical individuals up and down the, not only the computer science chain, but down deep into the sciences themselves, and then tying them to finance all in-house, because that's how you can really ask a deep technical question to the right person and kill your market risk pretty fast on the research side. And we can talk more about that, obviously, but just to give a flavor for kind of how to evolve on from a finance perspective, how do you kind of adapt?
Yeah, and I mean, that seems to me to strike it at the heart of another thought that Dr. Dirks offered during her presentation, which was that, you know, we're at a point in time where we need to embrace the non-linear. In other words, this is an exponential era that we're living in, and linear thinking isn't going to do it. So, I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is we need to surround ourselves with folks who are going to take our thought processes and our mindsets to kind of an exponential layer rather than just thinking, you know, on a linear scale.
I think yes, but I also think, like, you know, typically the finance folks they see themselves as the skeptics in the room, right? Like we need to make sure we don't make poor financial decisions. We want to mitigate risk. That's sort of the bread and butter of that entire field is understanding, valuing, pricing, and managing risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing to understand is when you get into the research realm, the folks in the research realm see failure way more often than folks in the finance realm. And so by nature, they are designed, like, to their bones, they're skeptics of what the data is telling them. And they don't want to waste their time. They want to see results. They want to see the products hitting market. They want to see impactful change. That's why, you know, they're spending their, you know, life fully committed to doing the hard things. And so I think instead of looking at it as we're going to take on more risk, if you actually have the right people in the room, those folks are extremely skeptical in their areas of expertise. And you can think of them as your diligence arm. When you're exploring a deeply technical problem, maybe Travis can talk a little bit more about the nonlinear aspect of, you know, development.
Yeah, I think The challenge is that because we live day to day, even though if you look around in the world, we're surrounded by exponentials, but we still kind of we're built to think linearly. Mm-hmm. And so I think the advantage that everyone has is probably everyone listening to this they've lived through the exponential. Like we all remember when cell phones were bricks and they didn't have screens, right? Like some of us remember when you had the rotary thing, dial the phone, right? If you just sort of think back over different timescales and feel imagine what you would have felt like yourself back then, where you handed what you have today.
Yeah.
And then just realize that the change that's going to come over that same time period will be about twice as much. Or said another way, that sort of a change will happen faster than it happened in the past.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good way to kind of calibrate yourself to start thinking about the future.
It's almost as if, you know, you need to start from a mindset that because we're living in exponential times, when you're thinking down the road, 3, 5, 10 years down the road, you almost have to start with a mindset that almost anything is going to be possible.
It's kind of interesting. No spoilers here, but if you've watched Endgame, the Marvel movie, Tony Stark's send-off remarks at the end really touch to the point of, you know, not knowing what to expect with technology and, you know, how someone's mind can just simply be blown once, if they were to go back, like Travis said, mm-hmm. see what actually came true. And I think we need to live more in that realm of let's see what's possible. I think, you know, after World War II, people were willing to take risks. You take Enzo Ferrari, for example, and, you know, the only reason Ferrari is synonymous with winning and a winning culture is, you know, one, they knew how to make cars, but two, all the drivers that he would hire were former, you know, warriors. They just came back from a battlefield. So, you know, if they needed to push the car over the edge or you know, make a jump or make it go on two wheels, that's just part of the gig. You know, you get champagne at the end, and it's a lot better than any outcome they just came back from facing. So they were willing to take those risks. I think you just nailed the heart of it, which is if you have a defensive mindset towards the future, you've already lost, mm-hmm. right? The best defense is a good offense. Or another a way that we put it around here is we say if you want to protect your past, write about it. If you want to protect your future, create it. Mm-hmm. So the changes that you can't imagine are coming, the changes that in general people don't imagine are coming, but the way that you prepare for it is you try to imagine them and you try mm-hmm. to make them happen.
Well, I was just going to actually ask Travis to expand a little bit on, you know, nonlinear technology development per se versus the linear route. You know, for example, like the development of a computer, a transistor, how that all evolved is very different from, you know, what we're used to. And let's say, you know, you backtrack 10 years to, you know, now it's 2019. So iPhone came out, a whole slew of companies came out. A lot of people learned scaling of tech businesses. You know, they went from being, you know, an undergrad to an MBA student to a VC or whatever the path might have taken them. 10 years is a long time. Like you're creating like a whole class of individuals who are now running an industry. And those folks have a very linear mindset when it comes to technology development, because what they've seen work, what they've learned through conferences and talks and white papers work, is a sort of linear SaaS development path. And, you know, I think our approach is extremely different. And it takes a little time for people to adjust to it, but it is the right way. Non-linearity is the right way for kind of deep tech development.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it kind of it ties into the next question that I had, which was one of the main points of Dr. Jerk's presentation at Digital Now was this concept of moonshots. This was a concept that came up over and over and over again, moonshots. So let's define our terms to you guys at XLabs. What does that mean? How do you define a moonshot?
So for us, a moonshot is that which, when achieved, changes the boundary between possible and impossible.
Okay.
It's pushing out that boundary of possibility and making people look at it and go, oh, if that's possible, maybe this other thing is possible.
That, so a couple of thoughts there. From our perspective, it seems to me that like moonshots typically come, I don't know, from outside our immediate circle, right? I mean, it wasn't somebody in the taxi cab industry who came up with Uber. It wasn't somebody in the hotel industry who came up with the idea of Airbnb. I mean, how do we say, you know, in the accounting and finance profession, start thinking in terms of that level of moonshots when we're, you know, in essence, we're busier than ever just trying to get through what we're trying to get through on a daily basis. Is it a mindset first of all, or I mean, what, how do we start?
Okay, it's a couple of things. So anything that is a moonshot, anything that surprises people in its achievement is sort of by definition, it's a thing that was hard to do. Mm-hmm. By that fact that it's a thing that it's hard to do, it means that the way you end up doing it has to be a way that doesn't quite make sense, is not intuitive for people who are kind of in the field. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just by the nature of that thing, because if it did make sense, they would have done it years ago, right?
Right, right.
So that kind of sets up all these things to be achieved by, usually, if not a person from outside the field, a thought from outside the field. Mm-hmm. So that's why you observe that with all the moonshots, why it always sort of comes from, it sort of ankle tackles you from the side.
Yeah. I think the way Dr. Drucks put it was that they when you're talking about moonshots, they by their very nature have to sound crazy initially.
Yes. I mean. Yes. Yeah. Tesla wanted to catch lightning, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, and I think it is a different mindset. It has to come from a place of, if you're in that I don't want to lose type mentality, if you're in that defensive type mentality, it tends to focus your brain. It tends to sort of tunnel vision. So one of the things that happens in a fight or flight state is literally tunnel vision. You're all your senses focus on the problem. You don't see the periphery. Mm-hmm. And that happens in literal fights, but it also happens in a meeting where you're worried about a particular thing. So you do have to kind of prep the room or prep yourself to be in this relaxed kind of safe space to think wide.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, how do you like what are some steps that we can take to start freeing ourselves from that you know tunnel mentality and kind of expanding the borders of our thinking so that we can start taking in some of these
I think the first thing is like relax and realize that this isn't a thing that you have to do all the time. Like there's a time for putting one foot in front of the other and blocking and tackling and sort of getting work done.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is make time for this other space to step away from the everyday and to give yourself that break to go, okay, this is what I'm doing now. And I think you'll find that just that actually helps a lot.
Yeah. I would also say like bringing in new voices into the room when you do that, voices that you typically don't listen to.
Huge.
You know, because you're usually tied into, you know, the reason that someone can come and disrupt you from the side, the ankle tackle, is because their physical limitations, like on what they perceive as 100% of truth, is different from yours. They don't walk in with the whole textbook that you've been taught on. They don't hold truth as, you know, religious doctrine. They're willing to play with it a little bit more. And so that's why some of the brainstorming sessions that you'll end up having, initially, you're like, that sounds crazy. Like, that defies a lot of the things that we hold dear in our profession. How can we think like that?
Yeah.
So, like, unless you create...
But you've got to hear that, and then you've got to check that response and go, wait, could we make that work? As the expert in your field, is that possible?
Yeah, we've gone through that process quite a bit.
I lost the thread. Oh, I was going to say, along those lines, I think you really nailed an important thing. Kids can actually be great, right? Because they have no preconceived notions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and, you know, and that ties into actually. I mean, you bring up kids, and when I think of kids, the first thing that comes to mind is that they're natural questioners. right? I mean, like over time, we lose that ability to ask really simple but powerful questions about things around us. But kids are kind of born with that intuitive nature. And there was another gentleman at Digital Now. His name was Hal Gregerson, who's from MIT Labs. He gave the closing keynote, in fact, that was called "Questions Are the Answer." It was all about asking better questions and kind of seeding that ability to be curious about stuff around us and just continually, you know, asking questions about the issues that surround us. So often our natural instinct is try to solve a problem rather than asking a better question about it. So that seems like like that might tie into this notion of expanding our thinking in this way.
Yeah, you've got to kill that thing inside you that it goes, this is just the way it is.
Right.
You've got to be willing to sort of kill that demon and question all those things. And then you've got to get comfortable with the fact that, like, good questions, they lead to answers, but those answers lead to better questions. Mm-hmm. So it's this, there's no end point. It's this, you are on this journey. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah.
From that perspective, like, you need to incentivize that somehow. Like, if your company culture or group culture is one of expertise, you know, I know all the rules of a Delaware C Corp, you know, I'm the Bible of truth of, you know, whatever the state is, you know, you're not naturally inclined to be the one to walk in the room and just ask 1,000 questions and walk away potentially looking like you don't know a thing.
Or to want to change the system that
yeah,
you know, your expertise is located in.
Yeah. Yeah. The constant knowledge, learning how to maintain knowledge is really important.
So Dr. Dirks in her talk gave this as a potential example of kind of moonshot thinking that might apply to this profession. So she looked at it in terms of three waves. She said the first wave, you think of artificial intelligence kind of finding anomalies based on full data sets, which is happening right now. You know, audit departments are using AI to take a look at full data sets rather than just samples. And that's happening as we speak. The second wave, she said, it could be something like continuous audit. That's just like a real-time audit utilizing technologies like blockchain, which it's not here yet, but may be coming soon. And then the third wave, she said, could be that moonshot. And she offered up an idea of predictive audit, which she equated to the movie A Minority Report, where folks were out there kind of predicting who was going to be a criminal and who was not and stopping crime before it actually happened. That idea of predictive audit, of stopping fraud and things like that before it actually takes place. That's the kind of thinking that she was putting forth that might be kind of a moonshot for this profession, utilizing current technologies and where those technologies might be going forward. So I'm just kind of interested to hear your thoughts on that. Is that an example of how we need to start thinking going forward?
Oh yeah, it's definitely an example of it. When you say that, the next step occurs to me, which is if you can predict the people who are going to cheat. Now you can start looking at the maybe causative factors and intervene ahead of time, not just to stop them, but to help them not be in a position where they are wanting to break the code, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But so moonshots are this, it's a Venn diagram of what's possible and how you want the world to be, right? Mm. So you kind of need to have both of those sides in the room in order to figure out where you're driving. There's the question, where's the most valuable place to drive? And then there's the question, can we get there? And you've got to kind of answer those things simultaneously and repeatedly as you're trying to drive towards the moonshots.
Boy, and that's a really good point that I hadn't thought of a whole lot. And I don't think a whole lot of people do. We when we talk about the future and where technology is going, we tend to focus on what's possible. And we don't spend as much time thinking about what do we want the future to be. I mean, you know, I mean, and I think that that's that there's a lot of power in spending time considering that.
Yeah, and I think it's possible that, you know, decades from now, people might look back at this era of AI really, really coming in and affecting a lot of things, and see that one of the most interesting things about it is it's going to force us to confront those what are basically sort of philosophical value judgments about how we want the world to be that we've managed to kind of put to the side for a while and just do our thing.
So what? And again, you know, I hate to spend a whole lot of time on this point, but it is the accounting and finance profession that we're talking about here, and this stuff is pretty far out when you're talking about folks who, by definition, have spent most of their time looking in the past, right? How do we start? I mean, what can we start doing today to start adopting more of a moonshot mindset going forward?
So listen, 10 years ago, I was a banker, mergers, acquisitions, and now, you know, working as, you know, co-founded and COO of X-Labs. And so, you know, it's taken me a decade to transition. So it takes time. But I would say that the first step is pick a project. Pick something that you think is tangible, something that you can actually wrap your hands around, set a budget to it. Start inviting the right people into the room. And I think what's super important is to include senior leadership and management in on those discussions. And you can even frame it as like, you know, if you have to, a marketing expense or something that is not expected to produce results in the near term. We're going to have fun as a team exploring this new technology just for kicks, just so we can learn and dedicate dollars to it. It doesn't have to be huge budgets, but it should be enough that, you know, in a year's time, you can have, you know, a portion of your, you know, quarterly, annual, whatever meetings be dedicated to discussing the possible instead of the practical. If you can get to that level of a project and you can define that project however you see fit, whether, you know, it's a basic project where you're trying to streamline a bottleneck using AI, that's great. Start there. Once you have your leadership team understanding that these are important types of projects, you can start pushing the envelope and doing more moonshot type projects where, you know, now we understand and have the capability to execute. You know, it's one thing to have an idea. It's another to have the system in place to actually execute on that idea. And I think the gap between those two phases is actually bigger than what people think. Most people in comfortable jobs where they're very, you know, the professionals and smart in a specific field always feel like the jump to, you know, the creator's side of the table is not all that big. But in fact, it does take time and you need to have the right resources and individuals around the table. It's not as simple as just hiring a consultant.
It gets back to that the nonlinear nature of it that we talked about, the kind of... the art to it is not so much the technology. Like you need experts in the technology, but the art is in getting comfortable driving when you don't know exactly where you're going and you can't, by the nature of the thing, you can't know exactly how to do the thing. You can't have key metrics that are this and we linearly move towards this value and then we know the project is a success. Yeah. It's a different type of management that is not nearly as codified as the way, you know, modern businesses run. And so right now it's kind of an art that you, like Sharif was saying, you just kind of have to pick it up through experience.
Yeah, there are layers of depth to this. You know, Radhika and I were chatting about, you know, what is the pipeline of like a researcher's pipeline, right? Like if you're an M&A banker, you can see clearly, you know, you go through marketing phase, you create some documents, you go out to market, you push, you get into diligence, you find LOIs, you sell the thing, right? So like there's a pipeline there that you go through and there's phases and process and you can double down on each phase, you can double back and redo something if you've done it wrong. So, you know, we've created a framework for it. I think on the tech side, there's also a framework for it. Academia does research really well. Bringing some of those principles into your team is actually quite useful. And doing it in a more commercial setting is possible. But that's probably a longer discussion.
And I would say the third thing that you kind of need to throw into that sort of hybrid monster is startup ideas around thinking of not so much about what's the next logical thing to do, but what is the thing that I can do to test this, mm-hmm. to test the way I think we're going as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is, I could spend all day talking with you guys about this stuff. Sharif, Travis, thanks so much for the insights, for your time. It'd be fun to have this conversation again in like a year or two and see where we are down the road. But in the meantime, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Yeah. Likewise. Thanks for working. I'd love to hear a year from now from, if any of these thoughts kind of rattle around in someone's head and causes them to go off in a direction maybe they wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, that'd be fun to see.
Thank you.
That was Sharif Halaba and Travis Dirks, the COO and CTO, respectively, for an organization named X Labs, which describes itself as a company that builds moonshot companies for the future, powered by artificial intelligence, unconventional computing, and neurotechnology. You can find out more by visiting xlabs.ai. And also, if you are interested in having your team learn more about deploying moonshots or AI at your company, X Labs runs an immersive multi-day workshop in Napa that covers what people without AI expertise need to know in order to intelligently manage or purchase AI, a framework for understanding the fundamentals of artificial intelligence and how to cut through the noise of AI to assess its true capabilities. So you can contact them for more details about those workshops. You'll find contact information again at xlabs.ai. And remember, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in a rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. We're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning. That's it, gang. Have a great week.